Hey, just quickly before we start today's pod, I just launched my new course, Unleash Your Potential, which is happening in early January. This is for aspiring professional rugby players. I'll be teaching you strategies and frameworks used by the world's best, and in it you will learn how to consistently perform at your very best while enjoying it more than you ever have. There's limited spaces in the course, and you can enroll now through the link in the podcast description. Dan Carter said recently, "At the start of my career, people would think there was something wrong with you if you were getting help from the team psychologist. By the end of my career, they'd think there was something wrong with you if you weren't."
Mistakes I would have made in the past would have been going in and being too complicated with a program, let's say a gym program, trying to do a lot of cool stuff. What sounds very small at the time, if you layer that and layer that on top of each other and layer on top of each other, suddenly there is a lot of work put in there. When I was at Munster, that Razzy Erasmus was head coach at the time. I was in the academy, and Razzy had, you know, that phrase all the time: without clarity, there can be no accountability. That is certainly something that always helps me, knowing the why I'm doing something or the purpose that I'm trying to achieve.
Hey, I hope you're keeping well. I'm Brian Moylett, former rugby player, now mindset and performance coach. And welcome to the pod. This podcast is about well-being and high performance. And in it, you will learn how you can be happier, more fulfilled, and more successful. I recently wrote the book on how you become a pro rugby player, Forward by Robbie Henshaw, which went to number one in the charts, and you can get this now on Amazon and Audible, with the links in the show notes. Please connect me now over on social media at Brian Moylett and at Offfield Rugby. If you enjoyed the pod, please subscribe to it, leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening now. And also, you can send it on to some friends. Would really appreciate that. All right, we'll get into today's episode. Cheers. Hey, hope you're keeping well. Today, I'm chatting with Damien O'Donoghue, former S&C coach in Munster Rugby throughout the different grades. Formerly Glasgow Warriors and now S&C manager at the Mardyke Arena in UCC. Cheers for jumping on again, Damien, who has also been on the podcast in the past.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me back on. Great to be back on and chatting with you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, good stuff. So, like we were chatting about offline, keen to start off, we'll always see where the chat takes us, but I'm now head coach of a team in Christchurch, so kind of like AIL equivalent, and we don't have an S&C coach, so we're in a gym, you know, like we're doing, as part of our preseason, we're in a gym. It's kind of like a CrossFit kind of, and it's just an important part of the whole program. And yeah, I've just been interested in that side of things, and from how I know there's many other people in coaches in this kind of situation. So yeah, chat to me about, like, say if you were to go in, and I know you have done this a bit as well, but if you were to go in and work with a amateur semi-pro team that is kind of training Tuesday, Thursday on the grass, if you were to step in, someone's asked to come in, what kind of things would you be thinking about doing? Or yeah, pretty open-ended.
Yeah, it is, but I'm sure it's something that is quite common, not just in your situation, but I'm sure here in Ireland, like you say, AIL, you know, I'm sure GAA here as well is obviously amateur sport. So again, quite common theme there. I suppose the first thing personally for me, if I was to go in, is me first of all recognizing, you know, I'm working now with amateur athletes, not professional athletes, and there is a difference. And there is, you know, as how you coach them, what you expect from them. So I think that's the first thing to realize. I suppose at the pro level, or at that really kind of high performance elite level, you know, you can demand certain things of people. You know, you still have to got to bring them along and coach them and motivate them and things like that. But you know, they're driven people, absolutely driven people in general, because they're at maybe the top of their sport or the top of the game, whatever it might be. You know, at amateur level, you might have incredibly talented people, but they may not have that mindset. You know, they may have the talent to go to, you know, the higher levels, but they may just not have the mindset or may not want to. You know, they may just not want to go that. And I suppose I think you almost have to embrace that. And it's something I've made the mistakes in before, going into maybe whatever it's underage squads or maybe, you know, in the amateur setting, moving from one to the other and kind of expecting them to train like pros. There's elements of it, absolutely. But first of all, I think you kind of got to embrace that they are amateurs. And then it comes down to, and you mentioned already, Brian, is the amount of time you have with them. And that's the massive difference. You know, you mentioned you might have them Tuesday, Thursday. So I suppose the biggest thing then really is prioritizing what is the most important thing. So if you take, I suppose we kind of off air, we kind of spoke kind of the example of a rugby preseason. So let's say you pitch Tuesday, Thursday night, you know, and then you might be able to get them into a gym setting, maybe either on those nights or maybe on a Monday, Wednesday, something like that. I think that would be a quite standard kind of pre-season for an amateur club, rugby club. In terms of gym, what you want to do is get the basics right. What you're really looking for, yes, you're looking for them to get stronger, but you're looking to move well and ultimately become robust enough to not only survive the demands of the season coming up and the sport, but actually to be able to thrive. So like you said, you know, you don't have a mass amount of time, and there's so many things you can do. Absolutely. And there's no wrong in that in a way, but it's just trying to dilute and dissect. And it's not reductionism in a way, in my mind, it's prioritization. Okay, what are the big key things we can do here within the time we have, you know, within the group we have in terms of learning and things like that. So from a gym point of view, I look at your kind of compound lifts. I would try and get them in, be technical with them, be patient with them. In pre-season, you're looking for a little bit more high rep work, maybe slightly lower intensity. You can do some tempo work, you can do some isometric, things like that. Also looking around, okay, is there some sort of kind of robustness type work I can do? You know, that'll be including your single leg, your core work, you know, your multi-direction kind of rotational work that you can blend in there. And really, other than that, you may not have time for a whole pile else. So you have your main lower body lifts, your main upper body lifts, and you have some supplementary work. What I think is probably important, especially as you go through the weeks, let's say it's an 8-week preseason, you know, as you're coming out the end of that preseason, coming into in season, I think you start sprinkling in things that are maybe, what will I say, a little bit more. It might be just some element of jumps, some element of explosive work that they can feel a little bit of competition and feel good in. Because again, you know, they probably have been working or in university for the day. You know, they're coming in the evening to try. And so there is that. And that's, again, I suppose, a little bit of difference between the pros and the amateurs in terms of you want to keep them motivated. You want to keep them engaged. What's the word I'm looking for? You know, you want to keep them coming back, you know, and I would be absolutely totally, and I'm keen to get your opinion on this. For me, the biggest thing with amateur athletes is the ability to turn up and show up. If they do that, they get better. And, you know, the amateur teams I were with who were quite successful, there was just a culture of them. To be fair, they'd created themselves at a club, had created where they just would always turn up and they just got better. The program wasn't any rocket science. It was very basic, if I'm being honest. But having a nice basic structure, having people turn up in consistency, it then gave me, the coach or whoever was there, the ability to kind of pick off individuals or say, you know, I know that person struggles with this now because I've spent a few weeks with him. You know, it might be something like he wants to do a bit of extra conditioning or lose a little bit of weight or put on a bit of size or might have issues, you know, he wants to get faster. You know, you can then start, I won't say individualizing, which it ultimately is, but you got to be very careful because you're only one man with maybe a squad of 36 or 40 players, but you can just start helping that individual, give advice, maybe change an exercise or two, and just direct them a little bit. I suppose the other side to that, and mistakes I would have made in the past, would have been going in and being too complicated with a program, let's say a gym program, trying to do a lot of cool stuff, trying to do a lot of, oh, this will be great, I really like this. But it's impossible in a way to then control, to measure, because there's so much going on. Some guys might be here 1 week, they're not here the next week, things like that. So simplicity for me there is key. It's prioritizing what are the most important things. I would go back to the compound lifts. I would look at some elements of core stability work, single leg work. I definitely have jumps in there. You know, you still can have your power work. But for me, how I personally would go, and this is probably the next step of our conversation, is when you put a plan together and periodize, you can then mark that out. But I suppose the key for me is prioritization and keeping it relatively simple and then build from there. That would be from a gym point of view. From a pitch point of view, obviously, what you want them to do is, and same from the gym, ultimately, you want them to be better rugby players and play well as a team. So again, when you think about your purpose of what your preseason is, it's ultimately to get them, you know, physically, psychologically, technically and tactically fit or conditioned enough to be able to perform the game plan for game one and into the season. That's ultimately what you want to do. So in terms of your pitch work, I would absolutely have conditioning as part of it, but, you know, supplement it. It would be a supplementation to rugby because, you know, I think in the off season you can give them stuff like doing some kind of standalone runs to keep ticking over, you know, doing some aerobic capacity type work. But then when they come in and they're together as a group, you want to get as much rugby with them as possible. You know, you say a new coach, I'm sure you've new ideas, you've new plays you want to use, you know. And what I would have done previously, have a similar situation where new coaches were coming in, would just say to them, if you want a learning session today, perfect. I will just make sure my conditioning then will be extra volume in it to make sure they're getting the stimulus needed. As that went by and, you know, week by week and into the preseason, into the season, obviously that reduced that amount of conditioning time I required reduced because the rugby was now taking care of it. They had the learnings, they were doing it in higher intensity, you know, not as much rest periods and so on. So probably keeping it very basic for the first 4 weeks, my focus will be around the aerobic work. Doesn't mean I would still do aerobic and anaerobic conditioning, but the big focus would be down that aerobic work. It's a good chance to do it. And like I said, you may have a lot of learnings from a rugby point of view. So the actual rugby conditioning element may not be hugely aerobic. But if that can be done by small-sided games or different games in rugby, fantastic. If not, it can be standalone conditioning. In that 4 weeks, I'd certainly sprinkle in a nice bit of anaerobic work because in the next 4 weeks, you're now preparing him for a lot of more repeated high-intensity anaerobic type work, anaerobic power, anaerobic repeatability, which is basically a repeated high-intensity because that's what the game will demand of him. Again, if rugby training can take care of that to the highest degree, brilliant. Again, I suppose, give an example of what I would have done most recently, amateur club, I would have taken elements of what I've learned from some great rugby coaches, distilled it down to very basic and made it kind of a simple drill. Basically, one guy carries into a bag, the other guy cleans out, and they keep rotating and going through that. So they're getting a skill element. The rugby coaches would then be involved and they would help coaching that, but we're conditioning them to what we want them to do in terms of from a rugby point of view. So yeah, that's probably a basic overview of Brian. You know, when you prioritize and know what you want, I always think about what the purpose of everything is. So you set your purpose for what your preseason is. Again, like I said, a general one will always be we want them ready to be able to play for the first game and prepare them for the season coming. From a rugby point of view, be able to execute the game plan under all stresses. And then you put a plan together for that, a process. And that starts with your macro plan. What length is pre-season? Where's the first warm-up game? You know, where the league fixtures come in. And from that, then you just break it down into little blocks, macro cycles or mesocycles or whatever you want to call it, maybe four-week blocks, and work from there. And I always feel once you have that, you have a nice structure which works off your fixtures, which is obviously set by the league and the coaches then selecting where warm-up games come. You can then start probably identifying what you want to work on a little bit more specifically in terms of conditioning or in terms of the gym. But I certainly, learning from some mistakes I would have made, I would make sure to be very general, especially at the beginning. Get the basics right. Get the fundamentals right. You can always build on them if you feel it's needed to be. But for me, with anything from an S&C point of view, and in this is pro or amateur, you need a strength and power program. Doesn't have to be unbelievably complicated. As I said, keep it simple. You certainly need an element of conditioning problem and a program and a way to measure that, whether it's the Bronco, whether it's whatever, yo-yo, whatever it might be. And I think then you can utilize areas. This is where you maybe can get help with the coaches or work, integrate with the coaches, an element of speed and agility in there. Again, you may not have a whole point of time, but it can be in the warm-up. It could be helping with a drill, you know, which it could be supersetted with a kind of a standalone change of direction drill, straight into a decision-making drill with the coaches. So you're getting some element of that. Those probably big three, I would always say, for me, are I would always prioritize around those.
Brilliant. Yeah, so many things there to pick out. But the something you mentioned earlier on, interesting, the movement and rotational work. And I certainly made the mistake in the past. I think probably rugby as a whole made the mistake in the past about 15 years ago when I was kind of late teenager and lifting heavy a lot and would have been powerful and strong, but I would have lost a lot of, like, I played a lot of Gaelic football growing up and soccer and basketball and those kind of sports and rugby. And I would have lost, I think, a kind of multi-directional kind of movement. I would have lost kind of movement and, yeah, just that, you know, I was playing number 8 second row, so just about running hard and straight and not too much movement. But, you know, nowadays, obviously, you see rugby players and, like, their mobility is just incredible. And yeah, I suppose just to expand on that, what you mentioned about, like, doing, say, movement work or rotation work in the gym, or just kind of expand on what you were saying there.
Yeah, and like you say, like, I suppose sometimes our thinking is almost, I'd say, one-dimensional, but almost 2D in terms of it's that one direction that we go. We just go forward, we go back, but you know more than anyone is it's such a multi-directional sport full of decision making, which we mean we have to be reactive. We have to be able to get into positions. Rugby in particular, when you take the breakdown, when you take tackling, we take scrummaging, you know, so many different areas. So I suppose if we want athletes to be able to get into those positions under high stress, they've got to be able to do it in times of low stress. You know, if they can't do it in low stress, we can't expect them to do it in high stress. And what I mean by high stress is training, games, and so on. So yeah, I think it's just exposing to them, you know. And I suppose I certainly have my confirmational biases, because, you know, I wasn't a very strong lad. I didn't play at a high level or anything, but I wasn't very strong, and core work is something I've actually taken with me and throughout, and I still think it's very, very fundamental. So it would be still an integral part of my session, especially early doors. I would do a lot of kind of, I suppose, low level basic core, because then if you set that stability, your ability to produce force and power and be explosive, it is certainly then is much higher potential. But if you don't have that solid base of stability, the old saying is like shooting a cannon out of a canoe. You know, it's no good unless you have that solid stability. So in terms of rotational work, I think that's so important. You know, but when you watch, you mentioned, you know, playing flanker, you know, you actually, if you watch some really, really good flankers and centers in particularly, they're able to accelerate forward, but they're still able to move. Their knees are still driving forward while their upper body is able to turn. And it might be just to throw the defender off to say, oh, I can offload this, but they're still able to create forward momentum, but they have the mobility to rotate their upper body without losing that forward power. And that is critical for me. And that's something I would certainly work on, and that's probably what I mean from the rotational work, you know, the ability to disassociate your upper body from your lower body, because ultimately you want to be able to, the knees and the hips and the ankle to drive forward to create that force, but then the ability to hand off, or maybe it might be even swerve, or just actually pass the ball to your left or to your right and still maintain that forward momentum. So, you know, there's so many elements you can do. You know, it can be as simple as something like a lunge and a twist. Very, very simple. But again, the ability to be stable when you land in the lunge, and now can I twist my body, my upper body across, disassociate my upper body from my lower body while still having that kind of somewhat of a running mechanics with my split position. You know, banded work is huge there in terms of rotational pal-off presses. And then as they get that stability, you can start doing that a more explosive. Now, can we put it in more explosively? You know, can I explosively move the band rotationally while still keeping that good, stable position? So, you know, working in different planes and in terms of that frontal plane a little bit more, because a lot of the things we do, and rightly so, a lot of things we do in the gym is you know, very much in that forward linear motion. But because, to be honest, the gym work, in my opinion, is always going to be general conditioning or general preparatory. You know, I think sometimes we can get a little bit down a rabbit hole by being unbelievably specific to the sport. If we want to be specific to the sport, you train the sport. You know, the gym for me is always such an integral part, you know, but can we make him robust, you know, can we help make him robust to be able to tolerate positions, be strong in positions, powerful, you know, probably another thing I really do like doing, and again, in the amateur setting, you may not have time for this, but you can sprinkle in as the season goes, are those kind of running positions. So, you know, like step up positions and what I probably like to call myself is hip conditioning, the ability for the hip and the ankle to be really, really strong in that high position, you know, which we need to do when we run, when we sprint, and so on. So, yeah, that's probably what I'm kind of getting at when I speak about that, because like you said, we do a lot in that linear plane. We do most of our strength work in that linear plane, but then I think you can put in supplementary work, you know, that can bring, it can be change of plane, change of direction, you know, some of your plyometrics work, you know, do your kind of skater pogos, whatever, skater hops, whatever it might be, you know, and you're preparing the body for that multi-direction work.
Yeah, brilliant. And you mentioned the hip and ankle there. And something I was even thinking about sending out to lads was like a hip mobility YouTube follow along, like, so that they can do it on their own, because we don't have 15 minutes to do hip mobility work on a Tuesday or Thursday, you know. But it is so important, because say if you're sitting down a lot, your hips seize up. I see it myself. And yes, was chatting about that. You mentioned like ankle and hip. I forget the word, something, but yeah, chat to me about that, because it's something I didn't quite understand the importance of. I think it was hip strength or hip...
Hip conditioning, but again, that's just a word. Some people call it run robustness. You know, it's basically being robust enough to tolerate those running positions. And you know what? Who was fantastic for me in this was the 2 years I spent under Killian Reardon, Glasgow Warriors. Killian is very process-driven. I learned so much from him. And I think I took this when I left, when I... worked at an amateur club for this preseason. You're dead right. Like when you're with the pros, you maybe get half an hour every morning or 20 minutes or even 10 minutes every morning to do some mobility work. Great. So you don't get that. However, and this sounds probably boring, and it probably is to the players, but again, I always try to explain the why. I created a very, very simple, about 5 to 6 minute mobility kind of movement prep for both gym and pitch that you do every time in the gym, every time on the pitch. Never, it didn't change. So the purpose of that was, it was almost trying to educate the players to actually, if this is something that works for you, you can do just more of this at home. Again, it was quite general. It was focusing on those three areas, probably we've spoke about already, ankle range in around there, around the hips, which you're exactly right, is where guys get, you know, stiffness in society these days. We sit a lot more, laptops, so on, and that T-spine, you know, and really focus in on those three areas, making sure they mobilize there, and then do a little bit of kind of low-level core activation, for want of a better word, And that would be it. You didn't go into your warm-up sets or you go into your speed mechanics from there. But there was always this kind of, it mightn't even be 6 minutes, I would say. It's probably close to four. But if that's done every week, that's, let's say, two gym sessions. That's 8 minutes a week. My maths isn't great. Yours is better now, but you can multiply that by maybe 40. And all of a sudden now you have a lot of time. And that's something I really learned from Killian. It was like, it's what sounds very small at the time. If you layer that and layer that on top of each other and layer on top of each other, suddenly there is a lot of work put in there. And the fact that you don't just change it constantly means, you know, actually we're working this area that we know is a high priority. Aidan O'Connell used to always say to me, a good mentor of mine, it's not athletes get bored of the exercise, it's coaches. We as coaches get bored sometimes. We need to change it. So, yeah, that was probably, it was just a strategy I put into place. I'm certainly not saying it's the ideal thing. It was certainly boring in a way for athletes, in a way, but at least I was giving him something to educate him. I was giving, you know, something that they felt they could utilize even away from there. And then, like we spoke about earlier, the one or two guys who might need a little bit more, you chat about, you know, remember that, you know, that exercise we're doing at the start every day? Can you do that twice a day for me, you know, even at work? Just take 5 minutes. So, again, it was quite simple, but, you know, I can't say if it was unbelievably effective or not, but it was a strategy that certainly helped with a potential issue.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And I see very clearly how beneficial that would be, hugely beneficial. And just even with the team I'm coaching now, a lot of the boys are working manual jobs like laboring or doing scaffolding or building or plumbing or whatever. And that, yeah, you can get quite stiff doing those things. Like if you're lifting certain ways or whatever, you know, doing the same thing. And so, yeah, I've even a picture in my head of the different exercises you would do for that, like you say, ankles, hips, T-spine, and how beneficial that will be. Because before I go to the gym myself, I do a kind of CrossFit-y kind of gym now, gym classes. It mixes it up, sometimes cardio, sometimes heavier weight, sometimes hybrid, whatever, just a local one. And we do that beforehand, just kind of those different, and they're always pretty similar. But I do feel, you know, it does help loosen me up and open me up. Whereas, you know, before Christmas, we did kind of 5-6 weeks once a week on the field. And I'm lucky in a way that New Zealand, the off season is quite big. So we're going into another 3 weeks of once a week. And then we have an 8 week preseason, essentially. 8 weeks. And so it's funny, the focus was retaining the players you mentioned at the start, is getting the players to come back. Because when I joined the club, half the team was leaving. I was like, oh, geez, that was a big issue or a big challenge I had. And so it was making the training exciting, making it something that people want to come down to, and, you know, managed to do that and everyone's staying. And that's always the number one for amateur semi-pro teams, is that, you know, the players don't have to be there. Yeah. They're not tied in. And from every angle, be it on grass, S&C or whatever mix of it, is number one. And that's hugely important. And I like that idea. I'm definitely gonna mix in that like 4 minutes at the start, because the boys, it would help them, you know, coming from work, coming, some of them are in college as well, but just getting that, yeah, you just feel good, you're ready to move once you've done that, you feel good. Yeah,
absolutely. And then you can go into a bit of a warm-up game where you're bringing a spark, and, you know, that element of enjoyment is still there, but they still get their 4 minutes learning. I probably actually have a good, when I started with Glasgow 2021, one of, like, I can't remember, were we in season or still in pre-season? I remember I just went in one weekend and actually made a video, pretty cool video, going through maybe 25 minutes of, you know, movement prep, banded work, things like that. You know, video was decent, goes through them all, but you put it out there and players, they look at it, but it dies after, you know, a week and things like that. So, you know, to keep it in their mindset, to keep it part of them, it's like any habit, it just needs to be done regularly. And like, I probably spent a good couple of hours on that video and things like that. Let's maybe it took me 8 hours in total. The 10 minutes or 5 minutes I did with them twice a week had way much more impact, you know, than actually that video, you know. It, and as cool and all as that video looked, and it was all great and looked really well, did it have the impact that we wanted? But doing it with them, even though sometimes they're, oh, we're doing movement prep again or whatever it might be, you know, just instilling that habit, that's where I think people begin to realize the benefits of it, because over time they begin to feel better, like you say, they begin to feel, oh, I'm actually feeling good here, or sometimes they come in an extra bit tighter. And what is great to see then, you'll see them doing one of the exercises that you usually do and just doing it themselves, because they know, okay, we've given them now almost a solution to their own problem. They were helping them problem solve. They have a tight hip or a tight lower back or an doctor. They know now the tool. They have the tools to actually try and, as best they can, solve that problem themselves.
Yeah, I love it. So true. It's building those habits that they can... Yeah, building the habits, you know, and it's the same with all coaching, and it's a big mistake that a lot of coaches make. I've made it a million times myself, in that, and it's some, not, I don't know what the word is, but you know, coaches will say, I told them that we you know, be it a play, be it, often that's what coaches say. Oh, we went through that play on the whiteboard back in 7 months ago on the Tuesday training before training. We went through it on the whiteboard. It's like, you know, it doesn't work telling them that, you know, like, often you have to do it, like you say, every day. You do it every day, and then it just becomes ingrained. It's building the habits. It's the same for us in every part of our life. It's building those habits. Like I heard it, I don't know, was it Tony Robbins or someone saying, like, they say knowledge is power, and it's like, no, that's the biggest mistake ever. Action is power. Oh. Doing it, you know. So it's like, and that's funny, we fall into ourselves. I think all of us do, is, you know, we'd be getting all this information, but what good is it if you're not using it?
Absolutely. And us as coaches, like, we haven't taught until the other person has learned ultimately. You know, just because we've said something doesn't necessarily mean they've taken it on board and they're going to action it. I remember I was fortunate enough to, I think it was a year and a half when I was at Munster, that Erasmus was head coach at the time. I was in the academy. And Razzie had, you know, that phrase all the time: without clarity, there can be no accountability. And I think that's huge, huge, you know, giving a clear message why you want someone to do something, so again, they can fully understand. But he used to actually bring it around again and almost not contradict, but said, actually, there is accountability. If there's no clarity, it's on me. It's on you, the person who is actually giving the information, you know. So being clear about what it is you want from players, I suppose, and the message you want to give, so that gives them the best chance of, you know, digesting that information and taking it on board. And again, it's something that I'm not actually fantastic at, and certainly have to keep working at on and prepare for all the time, making sure I try and give a clear message all the time. And again, I've always just put my own strategies in place to make sure I try and do that. But you are right. It's sometimes we feel like, just because we've, oh yeah, that's a box tick now, that's done. But ultimately, has it had any positive impact? Maybe not.
And yeah, it's so interesting. I think we all, as coaches, when we start out our early doors, it's our own insecurity that leads us to throwing loads of information, like all the knowledge that we have in our head. We get it out there. We give it all to them, every bit of it. And then we start, because we're insecure in that, if we give a simple message, that they'll think that we don't know more. And from my experience, I think that's what it is. Whereas then you learn, it's like, actually, it's what they receive and what they take on. And, you know, I remember once or twice, well, me being there many, many times, but we went through that. And I'd be perplexed as to how it's not being done. Yeah, we went through that. And you know, it's funny.
You're so right, Brian. You're so right. And now that you say that, I can picture like I'm talking maybe to a group at the gym board or whatever, and I'm going around in circles because, again, exactly as you're saying, I'm trying to act smart and I'm trying to pretend, well, trying to kind of portray I know everything about it, and I can just see blank eyes and faces looking back at me, you know, and instead of giving him the main point, okay, where you go, you know, if an individual wants to know more, he'll come to me and probably ask, you know, absolutely, yeah. Just out of insecurity and try to show that I'm knowledgeable or whatever, you know. That's probably where, especially early doors, probably the great coaches, they have that. They're very secure in themselves. And again, I do always bring it back to this, and that's probably my own bias, is having a purpose of anything, whether it's a session or whether what the season is. I think if you have a clear purpose all the time, it really does help, you know, almost a why. It can really help, and it certainly helps me from straying away from, you know, trying to give too much information, because if I know if I do, that's taking us away. It's not actually bringing us closer to our purpose. That is just white noise. So that purpose is almost like a question to keep me honest or something all the time, to say, hang on now, is what I'm introducing here in the gym or on the pitch or in this speed session, is that actually aligning to the purpose that we've set out, whether it's for the session or whether it's for the season or the block? And if the answer is no, then I'm just wasting time. So it should be out it goes. And you know, my experience around, and I've worked around great coaches and across all kind of strands, whether it be rugby, GEA, S&C, physios, whatever it might be, you know, looking at those ones that I really admired in terms of how they went to it, they were just very clear on what they wanted, and because they were so clear, the message they gave across then, you just knew they knew exactly what they were speaking about, because they were so clear in their own minds about what it is they wanted. As I said, it's something that I certainly have had to work at in my career and still do. But that is certainly something that always helps me, knowing the why I'm doing something or the purpose that I'm trying to achieve.
Yeah, brilliant. And you mentioned there, like, the best coaches. Are there any other traits or things that you've coached with in coaching groups with obviously some of the best in the world? But are there any things in particular you mentioned, just so what you said there, a clear understanding of what they wanted from the group, the team, the group, the coaches, and clear messaging around that?
Yeah. And what I think it creates almost is simplicity. It's taking what is such a complex sport, and it's trying to dissect it, or I suppose, into an element of simplicity that, because you know yourself, playing at a very high level in rugby, there's a lot goes on in the rugby pitch. There's a lot of decisions happening every second of the game in front of you. If you're polluted with a lot of, you know, tactical and overkill, that's when you look at teams and think, why did they look so flat? What is wrong? They're fit. They just look flat. They're almost overthinking at times, I think. What I suppose I found a lot of times with Grey Code, and they just had a knack, and it's hard to explain how they do it. They're so sure of themselves. They know what they're able to prioritize, what's the most important things to do in training or to identify in a game. Their message is unbelievably clear. I think that gives unbelievable confidence to the player as well. You know, if a player hears and feels the coach is really confident and clear about what he's saying, he's thinking, yeah, I know exactly, you know, we're behind that. That's, he knows what he's saying. We know exactly what's happening. The opposite can probably happen too. If a coach is changing a lot, if it's different some day to other day, that creates an element of doubt, I'm sure, in the player. And then it's like they're just an element of confused. They're not really sure what it is they're doing. They're caught between two strands. So, you know, and it sounds so simple, doesn't it? But it's not. You know, it takes special people to be able to do that, to be very secure in themselves, to be very clear in what it is they want to achieve. And really, I suppose, what I find with those people, because they know exactly what they achieve, when things maybe aren't going well and maybe someone like myself or an insecure coach would change, think, oh, I have to change, this isn't going. They're so sure, no, we're going the right direction here. We just need to, we can tweak, we can do that. But, and I think that installs huge confidence in players and squads and staff alike to think, well, this guy knows exactly, or this person knows exactly where the ship is going. You know, we're just hitting a few waves at the moment, but it doesn't matter. It's still going that direction, and we're all, rowing in behind that.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant points. And yeah, for sure. And I think a big part of it is you have to be comfortable with failing or with things not going well, or like, say, losing a game or losing your job, or like if you're worried, and it's similar as a player, like if you're worried all the time about the bad things that could happen, it'll cause you to tighten up and it'll cause you to play conservatively, be it as a coach, say like coach conservatively, just tighten up. And that then transfers to the players, you can feel that energy, and then that just doesn't give them the confidence to open up and to express themselves and to be their best selves. And it's interesting as well, then you talk about keeping on course or sticking to what your message is, what you're about, what you want to do, what you want to achieve. And that's like hugely important, because if you lose a game or two and then you come in and start changing things, the players will know you're panicked. And they'll panic, and then they'll think, oh, fuck, shit's it's not going well here. And it's, it's so important to know what you're about and to be confident within yourself.
Absolutely. And again, it does sound so simple, doesn't it? But simple and easy are different, and we're all human. And I certainly don't think I'll be able to do that. It's the ability to remain calm, and don't get me wrong, I've seen some coaches I really admire absolutely lose the plot when we've lost, but in terms of more about how the execution was, not necessarily about always to change everything. We're doing things that are totally different, because like you said, let's say you're 3 months into the season and you've been doing it this way, and now because we've gone through a run of results, we set our purpose for the season that we're changing halfway through. That creates unbelievable doubt and insecurity amongst the squad, everybody. Everybody's thinking, ooh, which way are we going here? What's happening? I would say that's possibly where, people can start talking, people kind of fractions break off a little bit, things like that. I think we should do it this way, we should do it that way, because there is uncertainty and there's insecurity. Those really, really great coaches that we see, and they're very, very clear and very strong-minded, and they give people the confidence, both staff, players, that no, we're on the right direction here, and we keep going. We'll make modifications in a certain way, but our purpose, our style of play doesn't change. We don't panic. We just keep going. We keep going. It's a great trait that having people, and we just probably don't see it in sport. I'm sure it happens in business. When you start off a business, you don't hit the money straight away. You keep working and working at it. I'm sure there's roadblocks. There's challenges. There's down periods. But if you feel your purpose is right, your process is right, and you keep going and keep going and keep going, ultimately, I think you can be successful. Where, if halfway through the process you think, oh, we need to change our business plan totally here, already you're probably putting, you're saying actually, I actually didn't do the work in the first place, because my business plan in the first place was actually probably incorrect. Not that I'm a business entrepreneur or anything, but I think we see a lot of this in all aspects of life.
Yeah, spot on. And interesting, just thinking back about the coaches, and a couple of brilliant coaches I was very fortunate to have as a player, just what you're saying, it's just resonating, is just the first one, Nigel Carlin, who you know, in Connacht, when I had him growing up and you were with him in Glasgow. And I remember his from day one when I was coached by him, say under 16, 17, it was all about skills, like high skill level, backing yourself, being creative, divergent thinking, and being in sync with each other, and just playing, essentially playing the way that like people would love to play. Yeah. And then that was kind of 17, 18, 19, having them, or 17, 16, 17, having them a bit, like maybe once a session, or once a session, the odd time, because he was the academy manager and I was underage. And then when I was 19, having them at under 20 level, like my first year under 20s, we played a very good game. We lost all three Interpros. You know, they're tight. We lost Munster by score, Ulster by score, Leinster by score, actually. But we lost all three, but it was that style of play. The next year, it was that style of play again. We won all three Interpros. We won the Interpros. And you knew that it was like, the message was, it was go out, express yourself, back yourself, go for it. Go for it. Whereas I never would have had a coach who would have encouraged us to play in the unknown, in that like space where things can go wrong. Like, it would always have been conservative growing up in Ireland, you know, kick to touch, scrum, line out, set piece, play tight, retain the ball. And we knew that he was encouraging us to play in that space of the unknown, and which is then the flow state. And interesting, just last one on that, I remember then going from 20s to play Connacht Eagles under Nigel again. And it was like, we were playing that game still. Playing that, and everyone has come to know that about Connacht now, but when I was growing up watching Connacht, man, just shite rugby. Like, I love them, but just not good rugby. But that's the way Connacht played now. And when we were playing Connacht Eagles, won a couple of wins, but I remember losing by 50 or 60 to Leinster, and they had like a brilliant team, and we kept playing that way even though we were losing, and we lost Ulster as well, and we kept playing that way. And look, as it transpires, then a lot of those boys have gone on to win the Pro 12, have gone on to, you know, do great things. And it's just, look, you knew under him that was how we were going about it. And then one other one, I remember Mike Ruddock when Adam in Lansdowne, like, the game plan was so simple, it was ridiculous. But like, if you watched us play, it was, I looked back at some clips recently, fucking electric. Like, some of the players we had, like, but everyone just did their job. And it's like, you know, we had some incredible players, but everyone just did their job. And I remember knowing, I just need to win lineouts. I just need to win lineouts. And he, unfortunately, like, kind of took away other stuff. Like, I remember telling me, we don't need you offloading, Brian. We don't need you doing kick, putting in kicks. We don't need you doing any of that. And I was like, I just wanted to be in that team so much. So it's like, clarity, best. Exactly. I just became the best in the, I wanted to be the best in the league. And we won, we were pretty much every duel we had, we won them in lineouts. And it was like, I just knew going off the field, I mastered the lineouts. I ruled the lineouts today, and everyone had their job. The tight head had their scrums, and it was like so simple.
That is fascinating, and that's the exact thing. Like, the simplicity then allows you to coach, really zone in or zoom in, I should say, on those important parts of what is important. What if it's complex? It's impossible to do that. There's too many moving parts. Where when you have a simple, and you know, it's probably like we were speaking about at the start with a gym program, if you keep it quite general, you can then try and zoom in on that individual and really kind of coach them hard or help them or assist and do it. Like you said, it's very similar with a game plan, very, very similar. And Nigel, like you mentioned, you know, lucky enough to spend 2 years with Nigel in Glasgow, and the attack has been fantastic there. And the first year, remember, we'd a bit of an up and down start. We'd win a few, and I think we'd really good away performance in La Rochelle in Europe. Got beat right at the end, and Nigel would do his review again. He's an uncanny way of being very, very positive all the time. Not in an overkill way, just very, very positive person. And as you say, the way he wants to play and the way he coaches is the same. So he was really, really positive. You know, things are good, but we can do better, we can do better. And I don't think it was the week after, maybe 2 or 3 weeks after, we had a a poor performance. Can't remember who it was in the URC and lost away from home. Again, Nige, quite calm, saying, look, we need to be better here. Very sincere in what needs to be better. And I think we won the next game, maybe at home, got a bonus point. And funnily enough, and I remember chatting to Nige after this, Nige was a bit very, quite hard on him the Monday after the win, even though it was a good win. And I kind of felt to myself, okay, there's a strategy there, a very clever strategy to say, you know, never get too low, never get too high, we can always get better. And he's a very, very positively balanced guy like that. And I thought it was very astute coaching, because again, it's just bringing everyone back. Don't get carried away. This is what we're about. We can still get better. I think they scored 5 or 6 tries. He reckoned we could have scored 10, and he was probably right. And he was right sincere about it. But he's a great way of that. Always positive, always where you can grow and get better. So yeah, I can see why that was an enjoyable time to play rugby.
Oh yeah, it was unreal. Great crack. Like, it was just... it was wild. Like, and we played, like, we were incredible. Like, we played with that 20s team the second year, and you know, the Eagles, we had a couple of good wins as well, but just so enjoyable. And that's another part of it. And there's all different coaching styles, but there's it's a big part of it is getting the best out of players.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a way, like you spoke about getting people to come back, and look, we all want to be there at that level, but you know, at club level as well, is getting that balance of, you know, it has to be really enjoyable, like the playing the rugby. Yeah. Like, you know, like these guys are, some of these, you know, one fella's 34, he's a scaffolder, he's great prop, great player, but like, he could easily stop playing. He could easily go and play like they say, fun rugby, or a level below, and not to, but this should be fun too. That's the thing as well, is it has to be fun. Yeah. It has to be enjoyable.
I think so. And like you said, they don't have to be there. They're choosing to be there. And yeah, it can be tricky. But you're right. I think, Brian, it's about trying to create that culture of enjoyment. You know, I know the last time we spoke about theming. I think it's very hard. It's very challenging to do kind of elements of theming when you don't have them for, you know, 5 days a week. You know, they're not in the building. However, you know, making it all about the team is still, I think, a massive, massive thing. You know, everything we do as an individual is to try and make the squad better and create that brotherhood of unity, that they just enjoy each other, they enjoy each other's company. You know, and ultimately, what you want that to be off the pitch and training in the gym. So ultimately on the pitch as well, you know, they'll get up that little, you know, that I remember, I think it was Ron or Gary speak about that element of care, to get up that kind of 0.1 of a second quicker to help your buddy beside you, you know, care for your buddy and care for the team. And, you know, I think that's important, but you are right. It can't all be just about winning, because again, like we started this conversation, it's not professional. You know, it's not, and I'm sure you'll have guys in your squad as well that are probably talented enough to play at the professional level, but for whatever reason, it's not for them. You know, they just mightn't have had that, because you know more than anyone, it's a grind. It's a bloody grind, the professional level, and you know, you have to be mentally ready for that grind. And I'm sure we all know a lot of talented players who, you know, still have the talent to actually play at the level in terms of the physical capacity, but it was more just the ability to keep going through the grind and keep going through the grind. It wasn't for them. Doesn't make them, you know, doesn't make them, you know, what will I say, a bad character or that. It just wasn't for them. They had different things in their life. So, yeah, absolutely, you know, I certainly had to learn that a few times. You have to embrace that. And because probably they're probably going to be your best players as well, you know, and you need them at that level.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I did pretty early doors and still need to do more of, for sure. It's understanding like why they play, what's driving them, where do they want to go. And like, I've guys in the squad who could be All Blacks, you know, like young guys. Mm-hmm. And it's so exciting, obviously, and they're on that path at an early age, or you know, at age specific, they're on the pathway to, you know, underage provincial essentially, and whatever. But There's also guys who are, you know, were in, say, the Crusaders Academy and want to get into kind of back into NPC or back into that kind of level. And there's also guys who have, you know, who never played any of that level but are great players and are 28, 29. There's the whole mix. Yep. There's young, hungry players. There's the whole mix. And it's something great about, look, a bit of a side point, be it at the professional level or amateur level, I think, which is hugely important. I see it more and more since I've left Ireland, is diversity. And, you know, having guys from different backgrounds, having guys, what I just mentioned, guys of different ambition, you know, some guys, and that's great. Like, everyone, you know, have a pint after the game. Some guys, if you want to play professionally and you told me that, I'll be telling you that you shouldn't be having pints after the game. Simple as, yeah. You know, if you're 19, 20 and you want to be a Crusader, it's probably not in your best interest to have pints. I'll let you know that. If you don't want to be a Crusader and you want to have fun, have pints, you know? And it's like, absolutely. So it's getting that balance, and it all builds, it all helps, you know, it all. And then the other one with the cultures, like, it's something I'm trying to bring into the club now or into the team, is just these different ways of being that, you know, say Tongan, Samoans, Maori, like, they all have their different ways they've, I don't know, teams, like, things they've done in teams and the different cultures, and it's class, and just bringing all that, because there's cool stuff, you know, there's so much cool stuff that me as an Irish fella, I had never seen. I was like, oh, that's sick, you know, and it's like, I want to do that too, you know, so yeah, taking all those best parts from everyone and bringing it into the team.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, get any of my dealings ever with any, you know, coaches from that area of the world or players, you know, they're so much into culture, and like you said, that element of care, they're really big into that, and that kind of brother, which is phenomenal, you know, and it can mean so much. And yeah, I think you're so right, Brian. It's like, if you go into a semi-pro or an amateur and try and say, okay, I'm going to put in a program, or, you know, we're going to play or train like everyone's going to play Crusaders. That's what we're going to do, because there's a cohort, there's 10% here, the possibility of it. It's going to be horrible for the other 90%. It just is. And they'll probably get, because it's not for them or for 50%, you know. Then if you go in and say, we'll just have fun and crack and we're kind of a pub team, for want of a better word, you know, 10% will enjoy that, but 90% of that will say, well, actually, we still want to do well here. So you're kind of trying to find a general, have a general then. And then, exactly as you say, if there's two guys who are potential to play, you know, you then give them, you know, at an individual level, you give them advice, you know, you can stay back and do goal kicking or whatever it might be, you know, there might be a hooker throwing to the line out. They just do extras, you know, same with the S&C. Okay, this is what you need to do. You need to look after your nutrition. You have to, and I think once you have a general program for everyone, you can then start to help those individuals, you know, that want a little bit more, that want something different, you know. Couple of guys might be going down because they just like being around the lads, but they might be great squad players. They're fantastic probably for culture, because they'll be at training every night, and so you make sure that you know it works for them. And you know, like you said, you might have your couple of mavericks who are bloody talented, not the best trainers, however, if you can make it enjoyable, at least they'll enjoy coming to training and you get the best out of them, and it's only good for the team. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's trying to find that balance at that level. Again, that's a mistake I've made previously, where thinking, okay, we're going to have a real kind of hard-nosed program here. Might fit 15, 20% of them. It certainly doesn't fit the others. So I think if you can try and you never want to go to the lowest common denominator. I certainly, and I don't think that's what we're saying here. It's more about just having a good general program, having an element of balance of enjoyment, but still trying to perform, still trying to get better, but an enjoyment of doing it, and a culture of everyone enjoying each other's company. Yeah, I think at times working hard, because if you want to succeed and be successful, you do have to work hard in training. That's part of it. But also, I said, if guys want to have a few beers after, fantastic. You know, if that helps the culture and the way you go. And if a guy is, because he's reaching for a different height, that's not for him, fantastic, good for him, and you help him out as well. So yeah, I think it's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah, I like what you mentioned there about lowest common denominator, and it's something just as well that just came up for me, in that it's a great point, but that I I come into this team as like sussing out like they underperformed last year and the last couple of years probably, and they all would say that. Everyone in the league knows that. That's just what it is. Like they're better than what they have been, and so just trying to suss out and just try and get a feel of the team, like where they're at. And yeah, I think you have to coach to the highest common denominator, you know, like, because you have to give those players what they want. And the other thing is that within that, then you can, you know, like you can push players more. So you don't push the guy, like you say, the guy who's up for, who wants to just go down for the social side, who's a good number 23, who's a good squad guy, who might play four or five games a year, who you need. And you don't fucking get into him as hard in the conditioning games or whatever as you do the other guys.
Hey, Brian here. I work one-on-one with rugby players, helping them perform better on the field, enjoy it more, and maximize their careers. If you feel like there's more in you and don't want to have regrets down the line, head over to offfieldrugby.com now and book a free 30-minute Zoom consultation. And the link is in the show notes. On the call, you talk to me about where you're at now, what you would like to achieve, and I'll show you how I can help you get there. You then go off and decide if you want to invest in yourself and move forward with the one-on-one coaching. For teams, I do mental skills sessions over Zoom. Players will have mindset shifts on the call, but also they'll get exercises to practice going forward. So it's like an S&C program, but for your mental strength. If you're a coach or manager of a team, you can book a free 30-minute Zoom consultation now as well on offfieldrugby.com. If you have any other questions, you can get in touch with me through my social media at Brian Moylett, at Offfield Rugby, or the website offfieldrugby.com. All right, cheers. We'll get back into today's episode.
You mentioned the prep to move. So I have an idea of like what that would be, you know, like kind of hip mobility, downward dog, bit of this different stuff, world's greatest stretch or whatever, these different things. And then so 4 or 5 minutes, 6 minutes, whatever, and then a warm-up game, like once again, and I got an idea of that, and that's kind of what I've been doing. But you know, just multi-directional movement, building up the intensity, fun, throwing the ball around, catch ball, you know, all that. And then yeah, what would be, so I suppose in training and then on a match day, what would be your warm-up?
Good question. So for, let's take our Tuesday and Thursday again. Let's first of all take pre-season. Have our set mobility, like we spoke about, our movement prep, whatever you want to call it, on the field. Keep it quite simple, 3-4 minutes. I then try and do some movement stuff, you know, in terms of trying to get them warmed up as such. I'd probably prioritize, doesn't matter which way you do it, but I would go linear type speed tech one, usually the Tuesday for no reason, and then Thursday would be maybe change of direction. So again, like any periodization plan, you start with basic stuff. As you go through your season, that becomes maybe more, you know, the change of direction stuff could be one-on-one things. So all of a sudden they could be doing activity, a bit of challenge, you know, the acceleration or top end stuff might be a race, or, you know, you can, in terms, incorporate both, where it's a bit of a relay with a turn, you know, but you sprinkle in a little bit of what I would call speed mechanics in there, or speed work training again, because that might be the only place you get standalone training. So all of a sudden now you might have an 8-minute warm up, you might have your 3 or 4 minutes movement prep, and you might have maybe 4 or 5 minutes, whatever it might be, speed tech or change of direction tech, whatever night it might be. So I'd kind of probably keep that pretty similar, the structure of that very similar throughout the season in terms of your Tuesday, Thursday. Interspersed then, you can have a warm-up game, you speak to the coach. So the coach might be playing a game anyway as part of their first exercise that is taken care of, or he might be doing a bit of a fun drill or whatever it might be, so that's taken care of. Or I know the coach I worked recently spoke to me, said he feels the lads are flat coming out of the warm-up, can I put in a spark game? Fantastic. We do 2 minutes in ball or whatever it might be. Like in Glasgow were fantastic for it, actually. I think it came from the time it was there before my time. I think Dave Rinney was a massive fan of it, being from that New Zealand background as well, just creating an element of fun before, and the guys go in sparked up. So something I certainly take, play, 3 minutes, leaving wanting to play more, actually, so they're going into the drill excited. And to be honest, Brian, I wouldn't overthink it much after that. Like, a warm-up is just can be general, can be warm-up. You could get a bit more specific where you could have a few stations. I know we moved to that at Glasgow, where we were quite structured for a while, and then we moved through some stalls, these called vendor stalls, where it might be four different stations and lads just circle around, change of direction. There might be a passing one, you know, there might be an acceleration one, different things like that, through poles, whatever it might be. But in terms of, again, you're trying to prioritise what the most important thing is. You have only maybe the lads for, I don't know, maybe 75, 90 minutes on a Tuesday and a Thursday, maybe less. So you don't want to eat too much into that in the warm-up. So I'd get your basic movement, mobility and movement prep. I'd do some form of kind of speed work, whether that be technical work or as you go into the season, maybe some short accelerations. The opposite night, then I'd change that for kind of change of direction or agility work, and then maybe some sort of a spark game. Other than that, and sometimes that spark game maybe not needed, you know, in terms of what's going to go, what's actually coming up in the session.
Cool, brilliant. And then on a match day, what would would it be similar, or what would the getting firing part of the warm-up be?
Yeah, so match day would be certainly much stricter in terms of you would set your match day. Ideally, you want that for game one. I know if it's new coaching, it might take the first few warm-up games to get it. But ultimately, like we kind of spoke about with your game plan, something as simple as a warm-up, you don't want that to cause stress. So you want these guys to know this inside out. Nothing too complicated, very, very basic. So you work back from your kickoff is 2:30 or whatever it might be. You know, work off, you know, how long you need for your rugby warm-up. You're usually talking maybe 18, maybe sometimes 20 minutes. It's quite long. You go from that. I know from, you know, when you'd work with when I worked at Munster and Glasgow, the same. You'd usually just give guys their own time. You give them maybe 5-6 minutes, make sure they're out in the pitch 5-6 minutes before that warm-up, and they'd like to do their own thing. You'd set up little stalls for them again, you know, so they can do tackles or they can do banded accelerations. I think for amateur teams, I think it's maybe better off controlling that to an element. So I would have a very, very quick spark, maybe 2 minutes built into it, where it wouldn't be so much mobility. You'd usually get that done before the walkthrough, that if it's a home game or maybe in the hotel if it's an away game. You just probably want to give them the feeling when they're out on the mat, you know, for that match warm-up, it's go time almost. You know, you're in mat zone. So that they're beginning, the adrenaline's beginning to rise. You obviously don't want it to rise too much, but you don't want to totally kill that either, by doing kind of mobility stretches and things like that. So it's a couple of movements, a couple more of a spark, a few accelerations, a few things like that, and then they would go in with the coaches. But that would all be timed, and to be honest, that's where you'd be kind of, you would almost follow, in my eyes, a professional setup there, because what you want to do, you want it to be structured. You don't want some days for guys to be thinking, oh, we're finished the warm-up 10 minutes before the start of the game, and going back into, and then in the next week, for whatever reason, we've ran over. It's now 2 minutes before the start of the game, and you want it to be consistent. You want guys to feel comfortable, know exactly what they're doing, back into the dressing rooms at the same time.
Attention members, the arena will be closing in 30 minutes.
So you just want them to be comfortable with it. So that's where most of the warm up on that day, Brian, would be rugby driven. It would be what they need to do from a rugby point of view, but I would put in maybe a 2 minute element of a spark just to get everyone aligned. Sometimes with the semi-pro, the amateur athlete, you know, they may be coming from work or they're coming from anything, just still not in the zone. Almost use that 2 minutes just to say, this is switch on now, you're ready to go, and then they go into the rugby warm-up. So that's how I would always structure that. Work always seemed to work relatively well, I must say.
Brilliant. Yeah, so what I'm kind of thinking of, just leading on from that, and so you have a walkthrough Saturday I don't know, 2 hours before kickoff, hour and a half, I don't know, whatever the time is. But early on, when you just meet, you have a walkthrough on the field. I think that's brilliant as well for the mental side of the game, because I would have done it myself, like, without knowing it, but just walking the field, because other people did it, I started doing it. And then I started feeling it helped me. So, you know, it does help you, just that kind of visualization, that kind of feeling the field, understanding the field. Versus if you went to an away game, and you walk, got from the bus to the dressing room, out to the warm-up, it's a bit kind of disconcerting, you know. Whereas walking the field, you know, half hour, 40 minutes before the warm-up starts helps just balance you and relax you. So what I'm thinking is you do a walkthrough, you do some mobility before that walkthrough, and then the guys are feeling kind of loose and limber. You go back into the dressing rooms for 20 minutes, half an hour. You might have a team meeting around then. Boys are kind of milling about, they're getting strapped, they're getting their boots on, whatever, having a few passes. And then what would you think? So then you come out, and I get what you mean about that individual time, and I get what you mean as well about controlling that with an amateur team, and I 100% understand and agree with that, and to control at some level. And so then from there, it's what you spend, what, 5, 6, 8 minutes
from a rugby point of view,
from they come out of the dressing room, yes, they kind of start, not a rugby point of view, not like, but I suppose starting from, okay, we're limber, we're loose, but to getting up to getting the legs warm, getting the body ready. Yeah, I don't know. Before we start the rugby, say, before we do, yeah, what would you be thinking around then?
Yeah. So let's say the game is on at 2 p.m. Yeah. You want to be back into dressing rooms at 5:02. Okay. The rugby warm-up takes 20 minutes, so that leaves us 2:55. So probably we're going to come out at, everyone has to be out of dressing rooms at 8:30. You're going to have 3 minutes, maybe 2 minutes, let's say, of your own time. You can come out earlier if you want, but everyone has to be out. 2 minutes of your own time to do whatever you want. Then 3 minutes are going to be in that spark. There'll be a couple of accelerations, maybe a stride out, something like that. Maybe just getting off the deck, roll and accelerate. So you're just basically prepping them. From there, then you're on the clock with the rugby lads in terms of, so basically only 3 minutes maximum, I'd say, of work with the S&C. That would be my opinion. Then what you're going to do is maybe go into a passing drill is the usual first thing. So again, you know, you're still just going, you're building and building and building. So the construction of the rugby warm-up is important as well. Whether, like, if you go straight into a breakdown drill where it's full on, they're not necessarily prepared for that. Getting the ball in their hands, getting calls up, getting them switched on, and it builds from there. Usually then you're probably into an element of units. After that, where they're breaking, now suddenly they're really getting into it. You might go into a breakdown drill from there, and then you're probably into your attack defense. That's the usual structure, and don't forget that the bag hits right at the end. That has to be done. There you go. So that's usually a rugby warm-up, I think, and quite generalized, but that's it. Like, from an S&C point of view, that's all you'd be doing is doing the 3 minutes at the start and then just directing traffic and just making sure that stays on clock. That works. And probably, you know, a kind of good story, when in 2015 I worked with Gary Owen as I was working with Munster. It was fantastic, absolutely loved it. But I was used to, obviously, the Munster senior warm-up. We had a similar structure and timings. But the first day I went out, I started roaring timings at guys, get out of the dressing room. They didn't know what was going on. And again, another example of me realizing I'm in a different cohort here. But explaining to them why we stay on, you know, why the timing's important. You know, I was lucky enough, the coaches that I actually worked at that level had worked at higher levels as well. So they understood that, how important that is, because you don't want the warm up to be the reason why it's causing stress. That's actually the total opposite of what it should be, you know. You'll be there to make people come, get them ready, get them mentally ready. You don't want it to be all over the place, so structuring the warm up is important. You know? And yeah, again, I wouldn't overthink it. I think sometimes we do, as S&C coaches, keep it basic, get them get them ready to do their rugby drills, and then the rest is then get them ready for rugby, because it's great if, yeah, they're I'm feeling good, I'm feeling fast, but they got to be able to do it from a rugby point of view. So to me, that's the coach's time. Actually, it's the player's time to feel comfortable, you know, in terms of, and they're ready to go. So you're just trying to facilitate the players a lot. The only reason you're probably strict in time or whatever is just to make sure that there's not a panic or a stress afterwards, because we're running behind. You know, we're rushing into the dressing room. We can't have our team talk that we usually do, or I can't go to the bathroom like I usually do for a minute and have my own time. You know, you keep that the same all the time. I think that is important. I think that is important. And again, like we spoke about, I think that gives confidence to players, just consistency, just the same thing. It's not the unknown. It doesn't throw them off, which is important.
Absolutely. So important. Well, Damon, thanks a mil for jumping on. The amount of knowledge and information, I literally have two pages beside me and I'll be listening back over to it. But unreal. Thanks so much. That's incredible.
Yeah, great chatting with you always, Brian. And thanks for having me on. Love chatting.
Cheers for listening into the pod today. If you're new to the pod, welcome. Be sure to check out some earlier episodes and subscribe wherever you're listening so that you get the new episodes when they're released. In my mid-20s, I began studying the mind, and that led me to playing the best rugby in my life and enjoying it so much all the time, like regardless of results. Whereas when I was younger, there were highs and lows, and it felt uncertain, like I was on a roller coaster. But then, when I began developing and harnessing my mind, it felt like I'd absolutely cracked the code. Now I work one-on-one with players, and yes, I help you overcome challenges, and we do mental skills work so that you can consistently perform at your peak. But I also help you expand your mind and grow as a person. You know the way you often feel like you have more in you. You have more to express. You have more to bring. And it kind of gets frustrating when, yes, you're getting some results, but you know you have more inside you. I help you bring that out. Every single player that I've worked with one-on-one for over 12 months has made a team that they didn't think they could make in that time, and or signed a new increased contract that way more than covered the investment that they made in themselves for the one-on-one coaching. If you're a player or coach and would like to learn more, head over to offfieldrugby.com now and book your free 30-minute Zoom consultation with me. Through this podcast, I want to help millions of people live happier, more fulfilled, and more successful lives, because I absolutely know that it's possible. If you want to be an absolute legend now and help me out, there's three things you can do. First is to share the pod. You can send it on some friends, share it on social media, and simply just tell people about it. Second, you can leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening now. On Apple Podcasts, when you click into the pod, you can scroll down and there's an option to leave a review and up to a 5-star rating. And on Spotify, when you click into the pod, on the left-hand side, you'll see a little star. You can click on that and then leave up to a 5-star rating again. And third thing, lastly, just make sure you're subscribed wherever you're listening. Those three things, sharing the pod, leaving a rating and a review, and subscribing, really, really help the podcast grow. Helps us help more people. So thank you so, so much. Please connect with me over on social media. Instagram is @BrianMoylett, @OffFieldRugby. LinkedIn is Brian Moylett. And any thoughts, questions, feedback, please let me know. I would love to hear from you. Thanks a mil for listening today. I really, really appreciate it. Be good to yourself, get after it, and I will see you next week. Cheers.